Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Adrienne Rose Bitar, the author of Diet and the Disease of Civilization. Adrienne, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So I'm wondering if you could start by just sharing a little bit about how this book came about, how you got interested in the topic of looking at diet books and writing this.
Diet books have always been on the periphery, as I imagine for many Americans, of my development as a reader. They were sort of a permanent fixture in my house, and I suspect a sort of ubiquitous feature in many American households because of their enormous popularity. I was a pretty democratic reader growing up. I sort of love the printed word, no matter how it appeared in catalogs or coupon books or diet books. And there was something magical and very attractive about the diet book narrative, especially the Atkins series, which was popular when I was a teenager. The sort of the ability to transform yourself, I think, is very appealing to an adolescent. And then when I studied food in college and I transitioned to my PhD in modern thought and literature at Stanford, I sort of brought that open-mindedness and recognized that diet books, even though they're very much on the, you know, the periphery of literature, if we can call it that, deserve recognition as a distinct genre. Not only because of their massive popularity, but because they are, if you're looking at boots on the ground practices of readership, this is what Americans are reading. You know, there's 20 million copies of the Atkins series sold. So looking at these books as like the actual material, the printed word, the sort of practices of literary imagination that everyday Americans are engaging with, that's what attracted me to the project as a scholar. But what kept me through it, through my 7 years of my PhD, was the profundity of the stories. I really came to recognize that diet books articulated powerful and deep-seated narratives about, you know, all the things that make the world worth thinking about God and man and nature and culture and science and human health and the American project, just like any work of literature does. So I, for a number of reasons, I felt like I was fated for this book, and that diet books themselves are a really important and feature and sort of a magical literary genre that deserves recognition.
And so you go through and look at sort of four major genres of diet book. But before we sort of get into those, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you're reading them, right? You're reading them through this perspective of culture and how they sort of impact and think about who we are. And so can you talk a little bit about that viewpoint that you came into this with before we sort of dive into the different diets you looked at?
It was really difficult to sort of collect an archive and to understand my approach. There's been really great work done on self-help and like romance novels, dime store novels, that shows the sort of the literary approach to ephemera or, you know, works that are sort of outside the literary canon is challenging. Like, you have to approach them not necessarily as, you know, highbrow critics. Like, if you're a highbrow critic criticizing a diet book, like, that analysis is going to last like 10 minutes because it's really formulaic and oftentimes not sort of, it's very sincere and formulaic and not ironic at all. So it's difficult for me as a scholar to approach them with the tools I had as, you know, trained in literature and trained in food studies, trained in history. And I had to remember like the sort of open-minded and sincere reading practices I had as growing up, which was to read them like thoroughly and imagine myself as if I were a dieter and not, you know, a critic. And it was very, very easy to do because diet books are so compelling and I think anyone reading them sort of falls victim to the seductive language of, you know, this is the story of mankind and I sympathize with you and together we can like reform your body and remake your diet and sort of reclaim your true potential and save the world. It's a really attractive story. And as a reader, especially even after reading hundreds of these, I couldn't resist it every time. Like I couldn't resist that story. Like I still love reading diet books. it's just they're really like attractive and fun narratives of transformation.
And so you look at these sort of different genres or different types of diet books. So you start with looking at the paleo diet and sort of harkening back to the cavemen. So can you talk a bit about those, the books that fall under that category and what you were trying to do in that chapter?
It took me a while to come up with a sort of guiding narrative that unified all these diets. I first looked at the 17,000 separate diet titles archived in WorldCat and sort of peeled out different narratives. So, and I had to discard some along the way. So like I discarded like the diets for particular diseases, like the testicular cancer diet or the breast cancer diet. And I sort of filtered out the like the snake oil salesman and the commercially motivated diets, like the Domino's sugar diet, the Welch's grape juice diet. And I had to sort of piece together the narrative diets. And the first narrative that stuck out to me, especially because I was writing this in 2014, 2015, was the paleo plan. And when I saw the paleo diet and I tracked that history out over the last 100 years, then the narrative of the diet genre on the whole became apparent. And that was the narrative of the fall of man, which is, as I'm sure you know, it's like the most common literary device in sort of Western history, that, you know, once we lived in God's grace or in a state of nature of peace and prosperity and health, but then something happened. And in the paleo case, it was the invention of agriculture, the development of civilization, permanent settlement, the domestication of crops and cattle particularly. So we fell from that state of grace. And now we're in this sort of pit of disease and despair. But as long as we work hard in the present, we can recapture that past and improve our now. So it's a narrative of human development and the sort of processes of human civilization. So when I saw the paleo plan, then the other narratives sort of revealed themselves of those 17,000 titles I first looked at. And then I was able to narrow down the 17,000 into like 500-600 individual freestanding books. And that's where I was able to piece out the other parts.
And so it was interesting in reading your chapter on that paleo diet, and you talk about gender in other areas in the book as well, but that idea of the role of sort of how gendered that diet had become and how that diet sort of looks at and I don't want to say plays with gender, I'm not really sure what to say, but how it sort of talks about gender and how it engages folks. And so can you talk a little bit about that idea and what narrative this diet is, you know, pushing in those ways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the paleo diet is very much the product of like a post-obesity epidemic controversy because it appeals largely to like a gender neutral audience. So I say gender neutral because even though the language is very masculine, if you actually look at the division of paleo dieters or ancestral health adherents, it's pretty much equally split between men and women. But that is extraordinary in the history of dieting because women have so overwhelmingly composed the majority of dieters pre-obesity epidemic. So I'd say this is like the late 90s, early 2000s. So when you get the paleo people coming onto the scene in the, like, you know, 2010, 2011, it was very easy to market themselves as a diet for men, because men and women were sort of both suffering the effects of the obesity epidemic. So it became a more collective concern. So it was easier to sort of beat your chest and promote this virile diet of like high protein meats and vegetables and attract a male audience. And the paleo diet also harkens back to sort of stereotypes about caveman masculinity and the role of the hunter and the hunter-gatherer, you know, division of labor, that brings us back to like figures in the earlier 20th century, like Arctic explorers and sort of colonial adventurers, like living off the land. Like you can even think about like Teddy Roosevelt and eating a really high fat, high protein diet of hunted meat. So there's like the hunting, there's the post-obesity epidemic narrative about, you know, our collective health problems and the sort of adventurer explorer narrative about sort of the wilderness and men's essential nature. Like it was just a really easy sell in that particular historic moment to create a masculine diet.
Yeah, one thing, because I can see the book and people who are listening might not be able to see it, is through in every chapter you have these images that sort of show and present each diet and representations. And there's one of the paleo diet that is this march of progress where you see the caveman and then you see a fat man holding, you know, a soda and then crippled over. And then the paleo brings them back to looking like strong and masculine. And that was one of my like favorite depictions in the book.
I was so thrilled to see that because it articulated the narrative that unified these 17,000 diet books in one concrete image. And you do a great job of describing it. It riffs on that 1965 March of Progress. It's, you know, so iconic. It's been parodied a million times where you see the, you know, the ape-like ancestor marching slowly on the page, like left to right, growing taller and smarter and bigger and stronger. But the paleo diet, like the other diets, completely turns that narrative like upside down. Like you see from left to right, the, you know, the caveman getting taller and stronger and bigger and smarter and more masculine, et cetera. And then descending into our current state. So he's getting heavier, obese, you could say, holding a soda. And then in the middle figure, he's like actually on crutches, facing the viewer, facing the reader. But then the really important moment comes, the pivotal moment where that sort of obese, crippled figure like is revitalized and shifted back into that original march. So we see the recapture of the like original caveman health. And I love it because it encapsulates this larger story about the progress of humankind and human civilization.
Yeah. And I loved it. Like looking at the photo, like when they start at the beginning, the caveman had the beard and the scruffy hair, but then when we get to the end, he's clean shaven, but he still looks exactly like the caveman.
Yeah.
So you move from, the paleo diet to sort of devotional diets and diets that are like Christian weight loss books. And so I'm wondering if you can talk, which was I found the most fascinating chapter, because I just did not realize the extent to which, and for the length of time, for the amount of time that we've had these sort of Christian weight loss diets and journeys. And so can you talk a little bit about that, that group of texts and what you saw in there?
You know, food and eating has been central to pretty much all major world religions. So it makes a really heavy, like yeasty topic for diet books. If you think about diet more broadly, like vegetarianism, the laws of kosher and halal, you know, the prohibitions against like gluttony, for example, or lusting after food, like really form a core identity for, you know, major world religions. And in Christianity in particular, the earlier diets oftentimes didn't address body weight explicitly, but rather railed on Christians for engaging in the sins of gluttony and lusting after food, even though that didn't necessarily correlate with heavier body weight in that sort of construct. But starting in the 1950s, there was an explicitly Christian weight loss diet genre started by a minister named Charlie Shedd. And it was really rough. He was not kind to his readers. He drew on his own experience, but he, like many of his contemporaries, like mocked and humiliated overweight people for being gluttons. There was another book at the same time that recounted like that awful poem, Fatty, Fatty, 2x4, can't get through the kitchen door. Like really these sort of horrific narratives of humiliation and shame. And from that position of shame and acknowledging that they were gluttons, urged their readers to reform both their relationship to God, but also their relationship to food. So there was a lot of material coming out of the 50s, 60s that argued like that Christians were sort of eating their emotions, like they didn't have a natural or healthy relationship to God or nature. So they were like poisoning themselves by engaging in these sins of gluttony. So it was really like a sort of a sad and unkind story about overweight as its relation to gluttony. But starting in the 90s, there's this big pivotal moment in the 90s for all these diets. This is so-called like onset of the obesity epidemic. Then these diets became a lot more optimistic. We have things like Rick Warren's Daniel Plan or the various like Christian fitness groups like Body for God or Holy Fit that enlisted all Christians, like fat or thin, sick or healthy, to improve the health of the nation, to improve the health of Christians at large, because religious Christians do have a higher obesity rate than Americans on the whole, but also because the obesity epidemic was read as like a Jeremiah, as a sort of crisis of not only of the nation, but of like the Christian project, that an obese congregation couldn't be a good congregation. So there was moves to reform like church practices, like, you know, having healthier Sunday picnics or using physical exercise as sort of an expression of your devotion. And in the 90s, they sort of picked up and totally changed their attitude towards dieters in particular. So with that pivotal moment, I sort of pick up my analysis of Christian or Edenic diets.
Right. And it's interesting. There's a great deal like you're talking about this idea of like, how does like God has created you, you know, God wants you to be this way, right? God wants you to be thin. God wants you to be, but healthy meaning thin, right? Or to be on a diet. And this is the way that you're sort of listening to God throughout these Christian diets as well, that sort of engaged people in both the diet culture as well as Christianity.
The relationship between like God and food and nature is really intimately intertwined in the idea that our palates have been hijacked by the food industry. So you see this in other diets too, but it takes on like a real resonance in the Edenic diets, because the argument is that God's instincts are in you to be healthy. And those are indelible. Those have been passed down from Adam and Eve. Like our instinctual preference for godly, healthy foods that will keep us like thin and in good health are embedded into like the biology, into the fabric of our bodies. But the argument is that the modern food industry has hijacked those instincts for their own profit. So the sort of hyperpalatable combinations of fat, sugar, and salt have assaulted our bodies, and we're no longer able to read taste. It's kind of a philosophical argument. So it's saying that because we live in this over-civilized world, we've lost touch with the instincts that God embedded in us. And now we don't taste, for example, a strawberry as sweet. If we grew up with Snickers bars and Dunkin' Donuts, that's our conception of sweet. Like, that's our method of calibration of what sweetness should be. And with that, like, twisted or perverse way to calibrate taste, now like a godly strawberry is bitter. So the argument for these books, and it may actually have some validity, is that if you wean yourself off of like the hyperpalatable combinations that the food industry has developed over the last 50 years or so, and return to just natural, so-called natural flavors, then your palate will readjust and you'll be able to taste like natural flavors for, sweetness and saltiness and, fatty mouthfeel that, are present in, fruits and vegetables and meats. So it's a philosophical argument, but there are doctors that recommend it. And if anyone's ever like cut off all processed foods for a week or two, you might recognize that process where, you'll taste a strawberry or an avocado after 2 weeks and the avocado will taste like really creamy, or strawberry will taste like really sweet. And then Coke or a Twinkie or ice cream tastes like kind of gummy or like fake tasting. So it's a powerful argument, I would say.
Yeah, I think there was a piece in this chapter about like eating the carrot and just feeling it like move down your throat kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And that's another aspect to these books that hasn't really been discussed, because after the 90s, there's this language of like sensual deliciousness that characterizes the Edenic diets, the devotional diets, that was completely absent in those earlier, like humiliating, shameful books. And a lot of scholars have said, diet culture is a descendant of sort of Puritan, like prudishness. Like, diet culture is about denying yourself deliciousness and denying yourself satiety and denying yourself the ability to sort of like be enraptured by taste. But if you actually look at these devotional diets, like put out by, the highest religious leaders in American Christianity, they do luxuriate oftentimes in a sort of sensual or a kind of like sexual language of deliciousness. Like, there was a passage about like the green globes of like natural cabbage bursting on your tongue and this like explosion of like bitterness and taste. And like, they're actually like fun and sensual renderings of like delicious foods that you wouldn't expect in a like strictly Christian weight loss diet. When you think about the prohibition against like gluttony and sloth in traditional Christian discussions of food and eating.
Yeah. And it seems like it's like very much, if when you eat this, you'll really taste what is made, like God has made kind of thing. Right. It's this natural taste that you get to be with God, but in these very like, yes, sexual connotations, in these sexualized ways.
Mm-hmm. And I may have cherry picked some of the better ones.
They're still
for
great.
The book. So, most of the diets, I would say, do sort of respect food in a very like sincere way. And the ones I put out were probably more extravagant than the mainstream.
But it's still, but there's still that history there, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you move then from the paleo diet, the Christian diet, to looking at this sort of primitive diets and wanting to, which you look at as different than the paleo diet, but this sort of what westernization did to Pacific Islanders and how people are sort of using primitive Western Islanders diets to sort of bring them back to being healthy. And so can you talk a little bit about those primitive diets and what you saw there?
they're the third piece on this larger narrative. So if we were to first think about, what is mankind's state of original health? Many would locate it in the cave, in the cave and sort of this like evolutionary origin story, we were first healthy. And then other religious people would say, actually it wasn't evolution. It was in the Garden of Eden that we were originally healthy. And then this third stage, more like liberal, I guess, politically minded people would say, actually, it's the processes of colonialism and the development of the food industry that has corrupted our natural foodways and brought about the obesity epidemic and the other concomitant, epidemics of non-communicable disease. So in this case, you can see it more popularly, for example, in like the Mediterranean diet or the Okinawa diet. But I chose to look at the Pacific Islands diets, like the Hawaii diet, because of their sort of real world significance. Because, Native Hawaiians have some of the highest rates of diabetes and obesity in the world, whereas non-Native Hawaiians or Hawaiians of different ethnic descents have earned the reputation of as the health state. So there's real sort of health disparities in the Pacific Islands. And that's what makes it such a like heavy and difficult discussion of promoting a weight loss diet based on some mythic conception of how natives originally lived.
And it seems like there's been a long history of Americans or others going into sort of these spaces, native spaces, and studying and then bringing back sort of what they're seeing and what kind of diets they're seeing that you sort of lay out. And can you talk a little bit about those sort of precursors for this modern move to looking at these diets?
It's surprising. I was struck that even as far back as the 1880s, 1890s, there were diet reformers looking, for example, at Inuits or how they were just Inuits or Native Americans as models of sort of like it indulges in all sorts of language we don't talk about in the same way today, but like in pre-civilized modes. And of course, no civilization is like a living fossil, but diet reformers like Kellogg, John Harvey Kellogg of, cornflakes fame, or a little bit later on, Weston Price, were looking at sort of pre-civilized tribes or civilizations to learn how, to learn about native food ways. So the best example of this is the American dentist, Weston Price, and he still has a pretty wide following today. He was active in the 1930s, and he published his biggest book in 1939, where he's kind of like an Indiana Jones of nutrition. He journeyed all over the world with his wife, to Africa, to Switzerland, and it wasn't necessarily like racially based. He went to France and Germany, Canada, Mexico, all over the world, documenting the effects of so-called Western diet, but largely processed sugar on like native populations. And in particular, documenting the incidence of dental cavities based on that transition to Western diet. So his book is like rich with these haunting photos of I guess they're dental photographs of people from around the world in the 1930s with their gums exposed and their mouths sort of enlarged to see the rates of dental cavities. And as you can imagine, the visual results are striking. Like you'll see, for example, a Kenyan that had been eating so-called a traditional diet, let's say in the early 1930s, with like really even white, clean teeth, and like a strong jaw. And then Weston Price contrasts that with someone who had, has poor, crooked teeth and what he considered to be an abnormal jaw. So it's really difficult to reconcile the like thorny and like ugly politics of this project with what a lot of public health researchers today and activists and indigenous activists are campaigning for, a return to native foodways. So it's really, really complicated political, public health issues that stretch back like 150 years. And there's really good work being done by like Hawaiian activists. There's activists of the Pima tribe in southern Arizona and northern Mexico on the U.S.-Mexico border that are trying to sort of reject a lot of American agricultural products and processed foods and return to a diet more typical of their ancestors. And Westerners have long looked at these as sort of a model for diet reform. So just because there's the Hawaiian diet, the Hawaii diet modeled after native health traditions, it's marketed to a wide audience. You know, that book took off on the mainland and it had a wide following of, you know, people from all different descents looking towards this supposedly traditional native Hawaiian diet to help them lose weight.
Well, and one of the things you do, and I thought was really helpful too, was sort of showing how colonialism, like you give the example of the Nauru, am I pronouncing that right? Like how the British came in and just sort of wiped out the land, and now they have much wealth from the phosphorus mining, but it's also sort of destroyed where they destroyed that space, and sort of what does that then mean for what they can and cannot eat, and what they have access to, and those kinds of things as well, is really important to think about when you look at these sort of diets in these books.
Mm-hmm. That story is pretty tragic, and it does bring to light the actual like political problems that, you know, the colonial interests not only introduced these foodstuffs, you know, like canned meat and turkey tails and these, you know, unhealthy concoctions, but the reason why those concoctions found a ready market is because the colonial interests had taken away their land, like literally strip mined it for, as you mentioned, the phosphate deposits. So it's this sort of, it's a very unpalatable combination of, well, I can't return to my native food ways because, first of all, no one can go back in history and everyone's a citizen of the modern world and no one's a living fossil. And I think none of us here want to return back to, you know, the food ways of the 19th century United States either, because it's, you know, we enjoy our modern conveniences. But also, even if that impulse was there, it's impossible to farm the land like they once did because the British and the Australians had such a strong hand in overdeveloping the land. Like Hawaii is also a good example of this. Like there's very little way you can sort of recapture, for example, the fishing practices of 150 years ago because of overfishing and because, you know, people have better things to do with their time now than, you know, than try to fish all day, especially if the waters are overfished. So it's all a myth of like returning to a mythic past, and everyone lives in the present. So it's very complicated racial politics where some people are considered more modern than others. And you can see this also in like the blood type, body type diets too, in which like some human beings are ranked as like more contemporary and more suited to the fruits of modern food production, and some human beings are considered like more suited to like unprocessed foods because they're not like fully participating in the modern world. It's really obscure and kind of full of quackery and sort of ugly racist politics.
No, I found that really fascinating, this idea that we can determine by your blood type what kind of foods are going to be best for you or where you live, right? Like, and that these aren't texts that were coming out 40 and 50 and 60 years ago, right? These are much more contemporary texts that are returning to some of these ideas that, yes, your blood type, or if we know where your ancestry is from, then that's going to determine what you should be eating or what you're sort of predestined to be and look like anyway.
It's fascinating because, as you mentioned, these things sound old.
I know. I'm like, no, they're not that. They're not that old.
Yeah, they're reminiscent of like Weston Price, who's using all this ugly language, but actually these, especially the nutritional genomics and the bespoke genetic diets, are like completely contemporary. Like the Eat Right for Your Type, what was recently revised in 2016. And in it, and this is a massively popular book, I think it sold 7 million copies, he categorizes people not only by their blood type, but said like blood type O stands for old. So those people should only eat old foods. Like they can't eat processed foods manufactured by the food industry. But type AB is the type that's a metaphor for modern life. So type AB blood type people can eat like Snickers and Twinkies and hamburgers safely, but type O cannot because they're older than us. Like it's very strange. And then he also has this weird language of like interbreeding and like mixed blood types that sounds sort of like the language of like miscegenation and like this old, like outdated racism that somehow gets a pass because it's in a diet book. And I'm like kind of surprised why no one has objected to this before. And I'm a little bit fearful, and I didn't put this in the book, but all this language about the bespoke DNA diets, like also bring this up in full fury. Like some people are better suited to modern foods and some people are better suited to primitive foods because mm-hmm. the assumption is that they are primitive. So just like the white nationalists are doing the 23andMe, like there's this weird sort of undercover racism that's hiding out, that's lurking in these gene diets that are like on the market now. So I suspect in the next few years, I'm going to have another chapter to add to this book.
Yeah, no, that was really fascinating because I was like, well, you know, this should not be, yes, right? Like, and that people, and the fact that like people are buying it in like droves, right? That you're not looking at it thinking like, why would I want this? Why do I? But
because diet books get a pass for everything. It's like, oh, if it works, it must be good. But then it's like, well, it can work, I guess, but you have to like subscribe to a philosophy. And this is the philosophy itself might be dangerous. Just like, and don't get me wrong too. A lot of diet books have articulated very racist philosophies about human health, like that 1975 paleo diet mm-hmm. was a eugenicist text that advocated for euthanizing imperfect newborns to like head off the population explosion. So that's the same diet that said we should all eat dolphins mm-hmm. and endangered animals because human beings are the superior race and we need to like cull inferior animals like dolphins, and we have to cull inferior like infants who are like blind or handicapped. So it was really ugly and like really it's sort of a terrible and like shameful precedent for the paleo movement today. And I think it's been largely disavowed, or it's been entirely disavowed. It's not a good book to read. And it exposes a lot of this sort of racist or eugenicist underpinnings of like the blood type diets today or the DNA diets.
Mm-hmm. And then so you move into this sort of final group of diets, which is, you know, and move us into the law. I think you're saying, but I also see it's like one of the biggest fads right now is this detoxification. And you do this and you've talked throughout our interview, but this is where you really look at how politics plays out, right? In this diet culture. And so can you talk a bit about that detoxification diets and what's going on there and what you see with that relationship to sort of food addiction and as well as like the politics of it?
Yeah, detox is very much like in common cultural currency. And one of the reasons it was so easy to approach was because it was political. It's environmental. It's rejecting environmental toxins and pollution and also the sort of amorphous metaphor of what a modern toxin is. So like noise pollution or stress or family discord or overwork. You know, there's all sorts of ways we conceptualize toxins that far exceed, you know, mercury in fish or environmental pollutants at large. And detox is that final step on this four-part structure, which is, you know, were we originally healthy in the cave? Were we originally healthy in the Garden of Eden? Were we originally healthy before colonialism, globalization? And this last step is the most contemporary because it's saying, no, we may have been originally healthy like in the 1960s before industrialization and the mass production of processed foods came into play in our sort of modern food habits. And also is a really easy topic to approach because detox, you know, whether or not it's actually true, markets itself as a sort of purification plan that isn't necessarily about weight loss. So many people can fess up more easily to be like, oh, I'm detoxing. That's why I'm, you know, forsaking like gluten or alcohol or caffeine, not because I'm trying to lose weight. Because in today's world, as I'm sure everyone knows, it's not exactly stylish to say I'm on Weight Watchers and I'm counting points. It doesn't jibe with like the, you know, body positivity and body diversity language, even though I believe the beauty ideals are still just as strict. It's just sort of marketed in a different way. So detox picks up a lot of the political movement from alternative food in the 60s and 70s with like vegetarianism and diet for a small planet, evaluating the environmental impact of agriculture, especially the environmental costs of livestock production, which is enormous. And it segues into, you know, the more contemporary push towards veganism, different segments of the alternative food movement today, like fresh, local, organic, sustainable, seasonal, ways that reevaluate the food system, not only in terms of human health, but also the environment and ethics. It brings together the whole sort of moral obligation we have to evaluating the food system and our participation as eaters and producers and sellers in a holistic way, in which we can't just say, you know, we need fiber to prevent against colorectal cancer and lose weight. It's like, well, you know, we have to evaluate the source of fiber. You know, if it's 8 grams in an apple, that's not enough. It's like, well, where is that apple grown? How is it grown? Is there pesticide residue? Who picked it? How far was it shipped? Like, what was the cold storage like? Like, if it's in an apple pie, like, how much is our waitress tipped? Like, let's think about the sub-minimum wage. Like, there's all these other implications towards food and eating that gets wrapped up in detox that articulates the sort of political impulse of what could be merely regarded as like a superficial eating plan.
Right. And you sort of look at then the foodie movement and its relationship to sort of this toxic food environment and what's going on there. And so can you talk a little bit too about that, sort of the foodie and this relationship to this idea of toxic food?
The language of toxicity and food really came up in like the 80s, early 90s, when in fact, like this detox is cool because there are facts that back it up, kind of like the primitive diet, the pre-colonial diet does as well. Like it's true that the environmental impact of agriculture and livestock production is hurting our environment in very real and very tangible ways. And these diets will alleviate that impact. And it's also true that a lot of the foods we eat today have toxins in them, however we want to define them as metaphor or as sort of scientifically defined substances. But it's dangerous, and public health researchers agree, like it's dangerous the amount of mercury present in a lot of fish. And this detox movement ties the health of the individual to the health not only of the community, like we saw in the Eden diets, and not only the species we saw in the paleo diets, but also the environment. So it's saying, you know, I can be really selfish and say, I'm not going to eat tuna with mercury in it, but it's also in my best interest to make sure the entire food system is clean, to use the popular word, is clean and just and ethical, because I can't help but be implicated in it. So in that way, I feel like detox does something really valuable for the environmental movement at large, because it's able to use what could be a very selfish motivation to like enlist support for noble and grand ideas. Like, many people might turn to veganism because they're trying to lose weight, or they're trying to be trendy, or it sort of has, you know, cultural capital at the time. And it may not work for any of that. The trend might stop. It's kind of become passé and mocked, and it probably won't help you lose weight. But in very real terms, it will lessen the environmental impact of your food choices. So kind of no matter what the motivation is, I think it's doing a good thing. And it's difficult to argue with that. And it kind of also revives some of the mockery that's been hurled at the food movement for being like trendy and superficial. You can think about like Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, or Beyonce's Lemonade Detox. There's sort of not fair assault, because the history of weight loss shows like you can be sort of superficially trying to lose 5 pounds, but also be ascribing to enormously deep and profound philosophies about human health. And in the case of detox, you could actually be doing good for the environment. So detox is a wonderfully like politically poignant mix of superficial weight loss, like deep-seated environmental activism, concern about sometimes about like ethics and morals, but it articulates a larger idea that we as eaters are implicated in larger food systems, that it's no longer a simple choice of, you know, me choosing apple over like McDonald's apple pie squares. It's I'm choosing to support a system that produces either McDonald's or, you know, an apple, or an organic, fresh, local, organic, sustainable, seasonal apple. Right. So there's different methods of being involved in the food system.
Well, and you sort of end your book, your conclusion sort of brings us to like, what does that mean, right? Like, you talk about this idea of a move from dieting to a healthier lifestyle, and how in having sustainable products, how the growth of food chains like Chipotle, and how McDonald's is losing business to places like that. And so in that conclusion, what are you like in looking at these and looking at these trends, like what are you seeing this all like this sort of narratives and this history is sort of saying about our culture right now?
This, and as a historian, I probably shouldn't say this, but this moment is, I feel, pivotal. Historians are always supposed to look back and say, for everyone, in everyone's lifetime, their lifetime is the most important lifetime that's ever lived. Mm-hmm. But I do see the culmination of a lot of different trends that have been percolating, like that has been bubbling in the stories we tell about food, our food practices, our food choices. And the numbers, the business numbers really support that. Like dairy milk, you'd think that is a just mainstay of the American diet. But plant-based milks, their business is growing by like 25% a year, whereas dairy milk is at like all-time lows. Like it lost 7% of its market, I think, last year. Soda, like what can be more iconic than a bottle of Coke? Soda is declining. What's going up in its place? Like a lot of times it's tap water or bottled water. Even Weight Watchers, Lean Cuisine, these are businesses that you'd think would be absolutely invincible if you were to study, you know, from the 1970s to the 1990s, even the early 2000s. But now they're all suffering. And I think the food industry is at a loss. There's greater diversity of, you know, different food companies. There's alternative meats right now, which has captured the public imagination, like Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat. you know, veganism and vegetarianism, if they're not mainstreamed, at least most Americans know about these alternative food practices. It's kind of an exciting time to be thinking about food from a critical perspective, especially from a business perspective. And I'm not sure what's next for diets. One thing I suspect isn't going away, it's just getting masked, is this language of like health and wellness oftentimes is used as a euphemism for what we would just consider weight loss like 20 years ago. And a lot of like wellness plans today are marketing themselves or conceptualizing themselves as markedly different from, you know, the fuddy-duddy Weight Watchers or, you know, even the Mediterranean diet of, you know, 20 years ago, 10, 20 years ago. But it's not true. Like if you look at the actual books and you look at the actual plans, it's just a continuous, like a continuation of the politicization of the diet book. And in a lot of the diets today, this sort of veneer of health and wellness reveals itself to be a quest for weight loss and beauty too. And not that there's anything like wrong with that, but it should be acknowledged that it's not markedly different from 20 years ago, the diet plans themselves. But what is markedly different is the food movement at large. And that's our attention to ethics and the environment and methods of production, labor. That is more reminiscent of the sort of iconoclastic alternative food movement from the 60s. Now I think it's mainstreamed into a greater awareness of our food systems, like by the American public at large.
And hopefully that'll mean changes in how we sort of approach and think about our food and the people who make our food and where we get our food.
Mm-hmm. I do see it is changing so fast. I'm not sure what diets are going to look like in 10 years, but I suspect a joke. Like, I think the next big diet will be the lentil diet. Like, there's something that combines, like, kind of this alternative hippie stuff with eating down the food chain, with beauty claims of like clear skin and renewed vitality, and weight loss all together, and ethics, and it all has to come together with environment and ethics and beauty and weight. And that'll be like the big diet. And then maybe some genetic like pseudoscience mixed in too.
Oh yeah. Which apparently is the key to making your diet really famous.
Yes.
Anyway. So,
I won't be writing that diet book though. Someone else needs to.
Well, this has been really fascinating. Are you working on anything right now that you want to talk about? Or are you just sort of like getting your book out there?
I am trying to write some mainstream articles. I'm really interested in the alternative meats and the history of meat substitutes for how the federal government has promoted meat substitutes, especially during the World Wars, and how that relates to the meat analogs today. I really want to do an article on a freestanding original article on the blood type diets and that complicated politics. And there's a few other ideas bubbling, but I'm not done with diet books yet.
They're too fun.
Yeah, they're too meaningful.
Well, Adrienne, thank you. Again, this is Adrienne Rosbatar, who is the author of Diet and the Disease of Civilization. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated this. This was fun.